9, Data Treasury versus Fiserv. Mr. Chin, please proceed.
May it please the court. May it please the court, Your Honors. The issues I want to talk about today is why the board got it wrong with respect to its determination that the Campbell patent anticipates the data treasury patents. And there are two primary reasons. One, the court had the wrong construction, came down with the wrong construction for the term subsystem identification information. And the second main reason is the Campbell patent does not disclose subsystem identification information. Now, going back to the first point.
Mr. Chin, let me do a little housekeeping here.
Yes.
In your reply brief at 20, you say it has come to the attention of Data Treasury that there were errors, and you gave us this chart, which I referenced previously. And then along the same line, you say in your reply brief at 4, and this is where I want to direct your attention, Data Treasury noted the following to the board. One of the first and most obvious and more obvious examples of such inaccuracies and mischaracterizations in the petition and of the errors in Campbell occurs on page 21 of the petition in the guise of a claim chart entitled Exemplary Campbell Disclosures. Although the statement directly above it declares without support that Campbell teaches each and every one of the limitations of Claim 1, none of the limitations of Claim 1 is compared in the chart. And you then reference me to JA3199. Okay, so turn to JA3199, please.
You're in the Fiserv Joint Appendix, Your Honor. I don't have 3199 in mind.
That's funny. Neither do I. That's my point.
And
apologies.
Part of why it's so troubling is because they argue you waived this issue. And you say, oh, we didn't waive it. We raised it. Just look at JA3199. But we don't have a JA3199. You didn't even present it to us. So their main argument is that you waived one of the issues, and you tell us you didn't waive it. It can be located on a page in the appendix that you didn't provide to us. What do we do with that?
Our sincere apologies to the extent
that
that's
not a question of apologies. It's a question of how on earth can we possibly say anything other than you waived it?
I recognize the issue. I'm not going to, you know, make any excuses for it. It is what it is in terms of omissions in the joint appendix to the extent that we've recognized them as part of preparing for this hearing.
Would
we've tried
like
to amend
to supplement
that.
Supplement it to the court?
We would like
24
to,
hours.
If permitted.
Yeah, if possible, you can serve it to the court within 24 hours. I mean, it's a single page, 3199, whatever that page was meant to be before you. I guess since you're in California, how about I give you till Friday, you know, close of business Friday, before you submit it, confer with them that they agree that, yes, this is the same page, and then submit it to us.
Thank
okay?
you, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Okay. My understanding is just that a lot of things happen in the course of putting it together, and there are various mix-ups. That's my understanding as to what occurred. But it is what it is in terms of, and our, certainly our apologies to the extent that there's any omissions in the joint appendix. Okay. Going back to the issue as to how the court got it wrong with respect to the construction of the term subsystem identification information, what the board did was to apply something beyond the broadest a reasonable interpretation. It went with what I believe one would characterize as the broadest possible interpretation, but going beyond what's in the disclosures. And what do I mean by that?
Why is it unreasonable? Why is the interpretation they gave unreasonable?
They're unreasonable because if you look at the claims where subsystem identification information is described, it's almost always coupled with paper transaction data. And it's almost always coupled with the remote data access subsystem. So that's already a sign to a person of skill in the art that these items start at the remote data access subsystem. Now, as a reminder, of course,
saying that the patent exclusively uses the term subsystem with the remote computer?
I'm not quite clear.
Your patent. I mean, we're trying to understand what the term subsystem identification information means.
Sure.
And so really what we're trying to figure out is what does subsystem mean in that case? And I thought the patent was discussing the different computers, whether it's remote, intermediate, or central, as different subsystems.
That's right.
So that's why I'm skeptical that you can say that when the term subsystem is used in the claim, it can only refer to one specific type of computer, when the patent itself is conceiving of using the term subsystem in all these other contexts.
In combination with the claims, how the term subsystem identification appears. For example, if you look at claim column 10 of the 988 patent, that's on...
Did you make a claim construction argument to the board? Did you make a claim construction argument to the board that subsystem identification information, as that term is used in the claims, must refer exclusively just to identification information relating to the remote computer? Where did you make that argument below?
The court's final written decision, as I recall, does cite to the fact that the patent owner, Data Treasure, did in fact seek a construction of information that identifies the remote data access subsystem or subsystem that is part of the remote data access subsystem.
But is it in the patent owner response or the patent owner preliminary response?
Let me help you out. Look at 4608 of your patent owner response to answer Judge Chen's question. Here, you want to see 4608?
Yeah,
you can read the highlighted parts.
Oh, great.
Because I already ran down this waiver issue.
Your Honor. Your Honor, is that the right number, 4608?
Yeah, but you know what? I just realized it's that response is in the other appendix.
Oh, okay,
in the
I
other
was wondering.
Case.
Okay.
So it's all right.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Just go ahead with your argument.
For all the kids out there, these four cases are all related to each other, but have different appendices. So there's a little confusion going on because all the cases are related and. So what I think would answer Judge Chen's question is found in a different appendix.
Okay. Going back to the 988 patent, in column 10, if one looks at lines 61 through 67, you have the disclosure that you can have you have various forms of identification information. That's specifically on line 64. And so what follows, so you've got this genus of identification information, and then you have various species of that. Transaction amount, the customer, comma, the DAT-200. And it's undisputed that DAT-200 is remote data access subsystem. You also have the transaction date, the transaction tax, the credit card number,
okay, suppose we disagree with you on claim construction. You have an additional anticipation argument that relates to whether or not Campbell in particular discloses one or more remote data access subsystems for capturing and sending paper transaction. As I understand your argument, is your argument that Campbell doesn't disclose that, or is your argument that the board failed to make a fact finding that Campbell in fact discloses that, or both?
Our view is that, first of all, Campbell, the board basically misconstrued what Campbell was in terms of what the system is. And that's at the basis.
Am I misunderstanding? I thought this was an independent argument that even if you lost on claim construction,
that's correct,
that you were nonetheless presenting an argument that the board's opinion failed to identify anywhere in Campbell where this limitation is in fact disclosed, regardless of how it's construed.
Okay. Well, with respect to the board's construction, information that identifies a subsystem, that is wrong because that is...
I don't understand what you're saying right now. Are you disputing the claim construction again, or are you focusing on answering my question, which is your argument to this court that the board failed to identify in Campbell this limitation, or is your argument to this court that Campbell doesn't, in fact, disclose this limitation? I'm trying to understand what your argument is.
It's that when the court said, excuse me, when the board said that the identity of the sending bank is the SSID, is the subsystem identification information, that is not the identity of the subsystem. What that is a name, is a label given to the entity that owns that, for example, Wells Fargo. That is what the board effectively has said. The name of a bank is the same thing as a subsystem identification information. What we're saying is that's not correct. You have to go to what is the name of the subsystem. You can't conflate the two. And what the board did is conflate the two.
You're presenting, quite frankly, a very confusing argument right now. I guess I thought that my question was really simple. Is your argument that the board failed to identify this issue? Maybe I'll just drop it and let you move on.
Yeah. How do you deal with Jack Henry?
In what respect, Your Honor?
Well, in Data Treasury contends PTAB, quote, improperly determined that Campbell discloses an encryption of the bank's identity, the PTAB's perceived SSID, close quote, which is where you were for the last 10 minutes or so. In 1050-1052, we look at substantially the same argument. Jack Henry, we determined the substantial evidence supported the PTAB's finding that Campbell discloses encryption of the SSID. You're nodding.
I'm not quite grasping the exact question. I wasn't sure if you were reading it or...
I asked the exact question was,
okay.
Quote, how do you deal with Jack Henry, close quote.
That they don't disclose encrypted SSID? Which particular, so we've got Campbell and Blackwell, and Blackwell's implicated in Jack Henry. That's why I wasn't clear about it, Your Honor.
Okay. I guess that's your answer.
Apologies. I'm just trying to understand what the precise
Precise question was, how do you deal with Jack Henry, close quote. If your answer is, I don't know, I don't understand it, that's fine.
With respect to Campbell, is that
yes.
Okay. With respect to the encrypted subsystem identification
issue, that's what I said.
Issue.
I thought.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. It's not disclosed in Campbell. It deals with other information, and it doesn't go to subsystem identification information. The information, the data that Campbell transmits, is just the identity of the sending bank. That is not the identity of a subsystem. That's the problem. That is basically what's missing. The board has conflated the two. The board has said if you've got the name of a bank, that's the same thing as the name of a subsystem. But they are not the same. For example, if in my house, the Chin household, you have a Wi-Fi network that has a different name. One is a subsystem, the internal Wi-Fi network, but then the name of the household is different. What the board has basically said is you can have the name of the household be the identity of the subsystem. And those are different things.
Mr. Chin, you're well into your rebuttal time.
Okay.
Do you want to save the remainder?
Yes.
Okay. We'll hear from opposing counsel. How do I say your name?
Rudman.
Rudman. Okay, very good. Mr. Rudman, please proceed.
May it please the court. It's an honor to be here today and at UCLA arguing this case. I'm going to address any questions that the panel has. You know what, we can leave those alone. I think that'll just be distracting. Any questions that the panel may have, but I'd like to specifically start with what is the definition of SSID and how the board properly construed the term and why Campbell anticipates both the claim, the challenge claims.
Well, you're, you're saying they properly construed the term? I mean, do you need to win on that in order to prevail? That they got it right? That they properly construed it?
If there's a different construction, I think Campbell anticipates regardless of how the board construed the claim limitation.
Yeah, but don't you only need to prove that it's within the broadest reasonable construction possible? I mean, you don't need to prove that
it's the
proper
construction, right, Your Honor. The standard is broadest reasonable construction.
So even if I were to disagree with you about whether it's the proper construction, because I do think it's possible for reasonable minds to differ on that point here. If I do think, though, it's within the umbrella of the broadest reasonable construction, then you still win.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor. When I
just didn't want you to take on a burden that seemed to be harder for you to win than what was necessary.
I appreciate that. And when I said proper, I was actually referring to what the standard is, which is the broadest reasonable interpretation under Quozo. So I apologize if there was some confusion on that point. Below, we believe that the Data Treasury appellant did indeed waive this issue. They told the board that they would abide by the board's decision of whatever claim construction was. Although they did refer to a district court construction, they provided the board with absolutely no argument as to why that construction would have been the appropriate construction, and that's what the board properly found. But setting that aside, we go through the standard claim construction and looking at broadest reasonable interpretation. And we look at the claim, we start with the claims themselves under Phillips. And if we look at subsystem identification information, subsystem, as Judge Chen, you pointed out, is used throughout both patents, the 988 and the 137 patents, to refer to remote, to intermediate, and central. It constantly refers to three locations, and also there can be other intermediate and central and remote locations. It's not restricted in any manner whatsoever to remote. And even if it were, Campbell would still anticipate, which I'll get to in a moment. It was added, subsystem identification information was added during the prosecution of the application. If you look to the specification, it's completely devoid of subsystem identification information. It's nowhere in the four corners of either patent unless you get to the claims. And the claims are immensely instructive. Approximately 50 times, 49 or 50 times in the 200 or so claims, they'll start with a preamble, the patents do, where it says subsystem identification information, remote subsystem, intermediate subsystem, central subsystem, and when you get down into the body of the claim, they switch subsystem with location. And location is used repeatedly. It's actually used in 71 claims to identify a location. It's not referring to a specific minute piece of equipment somewhere in the process. It's referring to the location, and there's a reason behind it. If we take a look at Claim 88 in the 988 patent, if we're looking, is actually very instructive because it actually modifies in the preamble subsystem identification information with the word remote. Why would they add remote if it was already included within that definition, remote, remote? It would be redundant, and they qualify it for a reason. They qualify it because subsystem includes locations, all three locations. So, moving on from that, if you take a look at what the entire reason behind the 988 and 137 patents, it's to convey information and to conduct transactions. Both patents specifically call out banking transactions. And all of us have written checks before. When you write a check to somebody and they deposit it in the bank of first deposit, which would be the remote subsystem or the sending institution, that check is deposited, and when they send it to a second institution, whether you call it intermediate or you call it a clearinghouse or a note, it doesn't matter. when you send it, they're not going to have any idea where to send the payment to if you just tell them, hey, it's a piece of equipment with a particular identification. The entire idea behind sending checks back and forth under the Federal Reserve System is so you know where to send the payments back and forth to. And it's actually covered in the federal regulations that was referenced by Dr. Knox and also by the by the board, but at 12 CFR Appendix D Part 229, you're required on the endorsement to add the bank routing number and the name and location so you know where the information, where the payments need to go to. And that's both ways. The 988 and 137 patents aren't restricted to sending information one way. It's got to go both ways. Checks are dishonored. There may be errors in checks. And that information has to go back and forth. So the sending institution, the intermediate institution, the central institution, all of those have to be able to send it back and forth. And, of course, you're going to encrypt it. And I'll get to encryption in just a moment. So the positions, one of the arguments that were made is, well, the patent teaches, a 988 says, well, customer information and transaction amount and date and other information can be SSID. We're dealing with the broadest reasonable interpretation. Any of those could be SSID if a bank wanted to use it. It makes no sense. It needs to be the location. It should, and it can't be restricted to remote. So I'm going to move on to the issue of whether Campbell teaches the encryption of SSID. It plainly teaches the exact, we believe, it anticipates, because it teaches the exact same system where you have a payer bank, you have an intermediate institution, which is the node, such as the Federal Reserve or another clearinghouse, which would be the intermediate institution, and then you have a central, which would be the bank of first deposit or reverse order.
Why don't you address the point that they make about whether or not Campbell discloses the one or more remote data access subsystems for capturing and sending paper transaction data, that element. And in particular, they argue that the board used your expert's testimony to fill in the gap. This is anticipation. It's not obviousness. So give me your argument. Is your argument either or both of the following? Is your argument that Campbell does, in fact, disclose that and the board made a specific fact finding to that effect? Or is your argument that Campbell doesn't have to disclose it and somehow anticipation is nonetheless satisfied by your expert's testimony? What explain your argument on this point to me.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe the board absolutely found that Campbell expressly teaches using a remote data access subsystem, which is remote location, which would typically be your bank of first deposit, where that bank where the check is deposited. I believe the board expressly found that. I think it's also inherent and express within the 550 Campbell reference itself, where it talks about the same structure, the identical structure that's claimed in the 988. They use different terms. They use remote instead of sending. They use intermediate instead of node, and they use central instead of the payer bank, but it's the exact same system of using three different locations. And the one or more, we only have to show one, but the 550 reference itself indicates repeatedly that you can have more than one remote. You can have more than one central. Dotted lines 24 and 26 in Figure 1 expressly show one. Those are referred to as one or more central offices. They precisely meet the limitations of the claims of the 988 and 137 patents. And with respect to encryption, Your Honors, the 550.
So it's not. There's just one little legal point in your brief. Again, it's interestingly citing the Blue Calypso case. It seems to be a popular one in your camp. But it talks about how a reference to anticipate doesn't actually have to spell out all the claim limitations. It's close enough if one of skill in the art would be able to envision the limitations based on the reference. That seems to me to be more than inherency. Does Blue Calypso, in your view, stand for an expansion of the inherency doctrine to something? I mean, inherency means necessarily present. the idea that one of skill in the art could merely envision something based on reading the specification, at least the way you seem to utilize it briefly in your red brief, would seem to me to be an expansion of the anticipation law. Is it your view that Blue Calypso stands for such an expansion?
I believe Blue Calypso stands for inherency, and the way you first articulated it, Your Honor, and it's not an expansion of the inherency argument, but a person of ordinary skill in the art reading the 550 patent, the Campbell reference, would understand and appreciate that that element or that step is inherent within the process, then it's an inherency.
Maybe I'm not recalling Blue Calypso correctly, but I thought what was going on there with the anticipating reference was that it disclosed multiple embodiments. And then at the end of the patent, it said something like one of ordinary skill in the art could and would, if it wanted to, combine these embodiments in whatever combinations it wants to. And then the Blue Calypso opinion said substantial evidence supports the board's finding that that teaching in Blue Calypso ultimately is an anticipating disclosure of a combination of two of the disclosed embodiments in Blue Calypso. So I think what you appear to be arguing here, which is an inherency argument, feels a little bit different than what actually happened on the ground with the facts of Blue Calypso.
Well, and we're not necessarily relying purely on inherency. My recollection is similar to yours, Judge Chen, with respect to what Blue Calypso stands for. We are not combining different embodiments in Campbell in order to anticipate, but all of the limitations we believe are present for all of the challenge claims and taught by the Campbell reference. With respect to, and I don't remember the exact argument on inherency that we're referring to. If I knew the element that we were talking about, I could address it more specifically with respect to Campbell. I'd have to go back and look at our brief of where we cited Blue Calypso to...
At least for some of these claims, does Campbell disclose the credit card data and the internet transaction data limitations?
Thank you. That's very helpful of what we're talking about. Absolutely. Right. The words credit card do not appear in the four corners of Campbell. And we believe that the board likely found that it was inherent. The important thing here is...
How is it inherent?
How
do you mean by likely?
I believe the credit cards were waived by Data Treasury. They didn't argue it below. But would credit cards be inherent within the four corners of Campbell that you could use other types of financial transactions?
What's the difference now between your version of inherency and obviousness?
Well, I think it probably is more of an obviousness. I'll concede that, Your Honor.
Okay. Well done. You people take note of that. That was really well done. Lots of credibility.
And with respect to, while we're talking about the, can I move on back to encryption if it would be helpful to the court?
You have 2 minutes left. You can spend them however you'd like.
So let me, if it would be helpful to the court, let me address encryption quickly. At column 5, lines 55 to 60, repeatedly throughout the patent, both there and also in claim 15 and also in column 6, lines 35 through 38, the Campbell reference explicitly talks about encrypting information and specifically sending information, sending institution, receiving institution, and the disposition of the check in the TCP/IP protocol information, but you don't even need to get there. Because what Campbell teaches is that you scan both sides of a check, which has, all of us know what's on the front of a check. It has the routing number, it has the account number, it has the payor information, it has the bank name on it. And then the endorsement, which is required by the federal regulation that I pointed out before, requires that you also have on the back the name of the payee bank, that's the sending institution, the routing number, and it's known that most people typically put their account number on the back, too, when they deposit the checks. All that information goes on the back, and when it reaches the other end of its dishonored, there's another endorsement where that bank, the receiving bank, puts their information. So all that information is put on it, and there's an admission in the record, which is appropriate, that Campbell identifies and encrypts the name of the sending bank, that it's scanned on both sides of the check are scanned. And this is in the joint appendix at 3231, where Data Treasury appellant provides persons of ordinary skill in the art would interpret Campbell as encrypting images that may include the bank name. That's SSID. It's encrypted. We don't even have to get to TCP/IP information, even though Campbell teaches in both manners encrypting SSID and sending it back and forth in what is a very basic, well-understood process and manner. And we believe it clearly anticipates the challenge claims.
Okay, Mr. Rudman, thank you for your argument. Mr. Chin will restore 2 minutes of rebuttal time. Where am I? Oh, there you go. 2 minutes. Thank you.
Your Honors, fundamentally, we have to talk about what Campbell is and is not. Campbell is a one-tier system. It is only what one sees within, in figure one, the public switch telephone network 10. It does not include the sending bank that we see in figure one. The system does not include 16, the receiving bank, in figure one. From looking at figure one, one might think so, but if you look at the claims, the independent claim one, it doesn't include the sending bank. It doesn't include the receiving bank. All it includes are things that are within PSTN 10. And you see what's inside PSTN 10 in figure 2. There's various subcomponents in there. So the system of Campbell is limited only to what's inside PSTN 10. So when the board says, well, the name of the sending bank is the same thing as information about a subsystem, one has to ask, what is the subsystem? The subsystem of what? Is it a subsystem of Campbell? It can't be, because the sending bank is not part of the system. How can it be a subsystem? That is a fundamental problem with the board's application of that construction. It reached beyond what the claims and the specification allow in terms of disclosing what Campbell is. If one looks at the specification, the discussion of figure one tells you that the system is basically only PSTN 10. There's no reference in the specification of saying that the sending bank and the receiving bank are part of the Campbell system. So you have this problem where the court has defined subsystem identification information as information that identifies a subsystem. Well, the name of a sending bank, first of all, is just the name of an entity. But even if one thinks that it might be a subsystem, it's outside the system. So it can't be a subsystem. That's a fundamental problem with how the board approached it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chin. The case is taken under submission.